Hello and welcome to The Lesson. My name is David Cowlishaw and in my day job I'm a teacher. But in this podcast I allow my guests to teach me about anything they like. No matter how obscure or unusual the topic, my guests will give a lesson on their specialist subject and you and I will be their attentive pupils. How they want to run their lesson is entirely up to them. All I ask from you is to leave your preconceptions at the metaphorical classroom door, settle down and enjoy the lesson. This episode, my guest is podcaster and Twitter legend, Johnny Sharples, who will be teaching us about grunge.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, lovers and haters, and all the people that call themselves players, and David. Imagine, if you would, that Middlesbrough became the cultural epicentre of the world, not just of Teesside and not just of England, but of the entire globe. The country's 15th biggest population, a place with an industrial past and long forgotten by those in power, but suddenly everybody wants to live there, dress like they're from there, have their films or television shows set there, and, most importantly, be like the bands that are from there. That's what happened to Seattle in the early 90s when grunge hit the mainstream. Grunge, which is less of a genre and more of a music scene, with many of the bands sounding nothing alike beyond their powerful vocals, nihilistic lyrics from disenchanted youths, and the occasional flannel shirt, but all having their roots in the Pacific Northwest of the United States of America. The first use of the term grunge, to describe music at least, was coined by Mark Arm when he nominated his band, Mr. Epp and the Calculations, as the most overrated group in Seattle. "I hate Mr. Epp and the Calculations," Arm wrote. "Pure grunge, pure noise, pure shit." After the breakup of the self-described most overrated band in Seattle, Arm formed one of the city's early successes, Green River, alongside Steve Turner, Jeff Amon, and Stone Gossard. Although they had some early success through Sub Pop, the band broke up with Arm and Turner forming Mudhoney and Amon and Gossard joining Mother Love Bone. Sub Pop began life as a fanzine, but its ability to identify bands and release compilations featuring the likes of Sonic Youth allowed it to expand into a full-time record label, beginning by releasing the iconic Mudhoney single, "Touch Me, I'm Sick." Also in Sub Pop were two other early successes of the Seattle music scene, Soundgarden and Nirvana. Soundgarden were superstars, the first grunge band to sign with a major label and respected and idolized with fans and bands throughout the city. Nirvana, meanwhile, were outsiders from the coastal city of Aberdeen, some 100 miles away from Seattle. But Nirvana's outsiders would all change in 1991. But before we get to that, we need to revisit Mother Love Bone and the tragic story that befell many Seattle bands. Mother Love Bone, like Soundgarden, had signed to a major label, and Andy Wood, Mother Love Bone's flamboyant frontman and archetypal rock and roll vocalist, was even Chris Cornell's roommate. He and his band were destined for greatness when, shortly before the release of the band's debut album, Apple, he died of a heroin overdose, aged just 24. From the ashes of Mother Love Bone formed firstly Temple of the Dog, a Seattle supergroup formed of Chris Cornell and Matt Cameron of Soundgarden, Amon and Stone Gossard of Mother Love Bone, plus local guitarist Mike McCready. The supergroup's breakout single, Hunger Strike, also featured the vocals of a man Amon, Gossard and McCready had already enlisted for their next musical venture. That man was Eddie Vedder, and that musical venture would become Pearl Jam. And so back to 1991 and the month that changed everything. On the 27th of August that year, Pearl Jam released their debut album, 10. A month later, on the 24th of September, Soundgarden released Bad Motorfinger and Nirvana released their second album, Nevermind. Nevermind's lead single, Smells Like Teen Spirit, put grunge and Seattle firmly on the map. It received mainstream radio play, featured on MTV, and by January 1992 had helped Nevermind knock Michael Jackson's Dangerous off the top of the Billboard charts. We'll be right back. Other singles on that album, such as Come As You Are and In Bloom, only served to increase the attention on the band and on grunge itself further. Nirvana's success also helped Pearl Jam's 10 and Soundgarden's Bad Motor Finger accelerate up the charts too and achieve mainstream success. Pearl Jam's Jeremy, as well as Alive and Even Flow, and Soundgarden's Jesus Christ Pose and Rusty Cage all achieve various degrees of chart success. Meanwhile, another Seattle group, Alice in Chains, saw their September 1992 album Dirt receive unprecedented sales, eventually going 4 times platinum. However, the attention that success brought also brought on problems for the bands, the musicians, and artists that were ill-equipped for such global recognition. Nirvana frontman Kurt Cobain and Layne Staley, the vocalist from Alice in Chains, both became heavy, high-profile, and frequent users of heroin. The rumours of Cobain's addiction were so rife that he decided to play off on them, entering the stage for the band's iconic 1992 headline set at Reading Festival in a wheelchair. Despite the issues many of the bands faced, the success of grunge continued. Pearl Jam's second album, 1993's Verses, debuted at number one on the Billboard 200 and broke the record for the most copies of an album sold in its first week of release before the band embarked on a huge arena tour. That same year, Nirvana followed up Nevermind with an album that returned to the band's punk roots, In Utero. The perceived commercialization of Nevermind had irked Cobain. He wanted to ensure In Utero was aggressive and almost inaccessible, and songs like Frances Farmer Will Have Her Revenge on Seattle did just that. While radio-friendly Unit Shifter played off on the commercialization of Seattle's music scene, songs like Heart-Shaped Box and All Apologies still proved to be mainstream hits. However, in November 1993, the band stripped back many of the songs from In Utero, as well as Nevermind and their debut album Bleach, to record an MTV Unplugged set in New York. It also allowed the bands to acknowledge many of their influences, performing covers from the likes of Meat Puppets, The Vaseline's and David Bowie, and their cover of In the Pines, renamed Where Did You Sleep Last Night, closed out the performance on a set that was mocked up to look like a funeral.
Fuck you all, this is the last song of the evening.
What is it?
The commercialization of grunge also became an issue, with record labels and A&R execs trying to find the next Nirvana. Bands such as Screaming Trees and the Smashing Pumpkins benefited off the back of grunge's success, as did the likes of Bush, Silverchair and Stone Temple Pilots. Grunge also gave a voice to disaffected women. The likes of Hole, L7 and Babes in Toyland also achieved critical acclaim and brought attention to cultural issues that may otherwise not have reached a global audience. In March 1994, Soundgarden released Superunknown, with Black Hole Sun becoming a hugely successful single, but grunge was all about to change. In April 1994, Kurt Cobain, frontman from Nirvana, died by suicide at the home he shared with his wife, Hole vocalist Courtney Love. He was 27 years old. Plagued by the pressures of success, mental health issues, and addiction to heroin, his tragic death signaled the end of grunge's time in the spotlight. MTV Unplugged in New York would be released as a posthumous album later that year. Soundgarden would then split up in 1997, and in 2002, Alice in Chains vocalist Layne Staley would die of a heroin overdose, aged 34. By then, bands such as Nickelback, Puddle of Mudd, and Creed were carrying the torch for grunge, with similar levels of success, but less respect of those that had trodden the path a decade earlier. However, Pearl Jam continued to tour and release new music almost 30 years after the release of their debut album. However, the overbearing shadow of tragedy still strikes grunge. Scott Weiland of Stone Temple Pilots died of an overdose in 2015, while Soundgarden's Chris Cornell died by suicide in 2017. Grunge was a scene that existed in duality. It reached the highest of highs and the lowest of lows, featured incredible performances by troubled performers. It hit the mainstream while still remaining underground, a genre that's moment in the limelight was so fleeting, but still burns so brightly today.
Johnny, thank you so much for your lecture on grunge. I'm gonna start with a sort of your relationship with grunge, then, given we've got a really sort of nice and concise history there from you. How does music from Seattle reach you in what I'm assuming would have been Preston, Lancashire at the time? How did that music sort of make its way into your world?
I know where it, exactly where it came from. My sister, she's 8 years older than me, so she was like early to mid-teens when grunge had its real heyday, especially in this country. And I think she probably had a very fleeting relationship with grunge. I think she probably either bought or was given a cassette recording of Nevermind. She also had 10 by Pearl Jam. And I know she had a recording of MTV Unplugged in New York. And she would have played those while I was around. Obviously, I was really young, didn't appreciate what the lyrics were about. But those, like especially the start of Alive and Even Flow by Pearl Jam, are such iconic intros that they stuck with me for a long time. And years later, I think I went on a holiday to Barnard Castle, the infamous northeast town, with my parents, and I just grabbed a load of cassettes to have on a cassette player, and I remember sticking one in and hearing Nirvana MTV Unplugged in New York, and texting my sister, unsure of who it was, and said, "I've sort of must have drawn up the memories of who Nirvana were," and I just texted some lyrics and said, "Is this by Nirvana?" And she replied saying, "Yeah." And from then on in, like probably about 13 or 14 at the time, probably a similar age to what she was when she first started listening to them, I was absolutely hooked on Pearl Jam and Nirvana, and then basically dug deep from there on in and found out about Soundgarden and Alice in Chains and a lot of the other bands that I mentioned when I was speaking to you earlier.
I think in terms of the names that leapt off my notes when I was writing them down there, Pearl Jam and Nirvana, probably by far the sort of most well known in sort of the mainstream terms there. So I gather they sort of opened up the genre for you. Is that sort of how you find most sort of grunge fans' entrance into it? Is it through those two massive bands, do you think?
Yeah, I'd say there's a few genres where the big four gets mentioned. I think like Metallica, Megadeth, Slayer and Anthrax are one in thrash metal. But in grunge, you have Nirvana, you have Pearl Jam, you have Soundgarden, you have Alice in Chains. And those are the four massive ones. And I think I touched on a bit at the start of my lecture there. Grunge as a whole, especially in the early days when it was still very heavily based in Seattle and they haven't sort of expanded out, that was quite an incestuous genre, and a lot of the bands lent members to other bands, and so when you're trying to find out new music, it's easy to go back and find out that, you know, Pearl Jam came out of Temple of the Dog, and so did Soundgarden, contributed to Temple of the Dog, and Soundgarden's drummer Matt Cameron then joined Pearl Jam and all this sort of stuff. So Green River, Mudhoney, they're all related, and Mother Love Bone as well. So you find out these bands, because I used to find out a lot of bands by reading the liner notes in albums and who they thanked on their albums that way. But like if you've got a family tree of Seattle music, you basically have every single band that ever came out of Seattle in one small thing. So it's quite easy to find out about that. And like Smashing Pumpkins and Screaming Trees and Silverchair, Stone Temple Pilots, a lot of them still had, and Hole still had huge, you know, like I say, like people really wanted to find the next big thing in Seattle, so they signed all these bands and that helped them go huge. So it was quite easy to find these other bands as well. But Nirvana and Pearl Jam were definitely a good starting point. Anyone that wants to sort of delve further into that genre, those are the good starting points as well. But it's a bit weird because, like I say, none of the bands really sound like one another. They have so many varied influences. Like Nirvana's big influence was like Pixies and punk music and the Melvins and things like that. And Pearl Jam's influences were more like The Who and sort of classic-y British rock music. Mm. Eddie Vedder had a big relationship with Fugazi, that he wanted the band to be more like Fugazi, and they just didn't. They sound like The Who. Soundgarden were obsessed with Black Sabbath and rock music, and then Alice in Chains were really into sort of dirty, sludgy metal music. So it's weird that they're all lumped together as one genre, when really it's just a music scene that exploded.
So it's perhaps hard to define musically then, sort of as a genre. You said it's more of a scene than a genre. It is this sort of Seattle music scene that exploded. Would you be able to recognize sort of off you know, just from hearing something, whether you would class it as grunge music or not then, or would that be sort of more to do with where it came from rather than what it sounded like?
I think because it exploit like Silverchair from Australia, but you can sort of, they do have definite defined character. Basically, they just wanted to sound like Nirvana, so they do have defined characteristics. Similarly, Bush were from the UK, so and they, I think a lot of grunge is based around what the lyrics say, because it was a real political era in the early 90s. Like Reagan was in charge in America, and they'd had a lot of sort of conservative legislation imposed on them, and a lot of what Seattle was about was the fact that I mentioned Middlesbrough at the start of it is probably a good example of what it would be like here. It's sort of a place that's forgotten about. Bands didn't tend to tour Seattle until grunge exploded. It was sort of because it was so far off into the northwest of America, people just didn't go there. You know, they did a date in LA, maybe San Diego, and that was them sorted for that side of the country. So I think they need to have sort of a disaffected, you know, disenchanted relationship. Nihilism is a big thing that plays into it. And then just the strong vocals, even bands like Hole in L7, where it's, you know, female vocals, there's still a strong, powerful voice there. And Eddie Vedder, Chris Cornell probably have the two strong, definitely the two strongest voices out of that era. And, you know, if you want to sound like a grunge band, that's what you need. You need someone that can have that power in their voice and hold those notes and just sound incredible.
I'm picturing a explosion in a Middlesbrough music scene based around Chris Rea at the moment, but returning to grunge then, I'm going to quote from Wikipedia now, so excuse me if this is just completely wrong, but it describes the lyrics that you talked about there as typically angst-filled and introspective, often addressing themes such as social alienation, self-doubt, abuse, neglect, betrayal, social and emotional isolation, psychological trauma, and a desire for freedom. Now, without wanting to paint a picture of young Johnny Sharples, did any of those themes appeal, or was it more sort of love of the music as it sounded, or was there sort of maybe a crossover of the two?
I think mainly it was how the music sounded. Like I say, the voices of just that power behind Chris Cornell and Eddie Vedder's voice had a lasting impact on me. But like I'd say more like as I got further into sort of Pearl Jam's back catalogue and listened to more of their music, 10 necessarily, the relationship with that, like a lot of the big songs are like, Jeremy's about a school shooting. Alive is about Eddie Vedder realizing that the man that he grew up thinking was his dad wasn't actually his dad. Even Flow's about homelessness. So these weren't things that I personally had like touched on, but when they sort of expanded further onto those sort of more personal themes about, you know, self-doubt and things like that, as I got older and, you know, you become more self-conscious and things like that and want to fit in a bit more, they resonated a lot with me. And similarly, Nirvana was more about themselves and as a general what it's like to be, like you say, angsty and teenage. Nirvana really covered that. And I still not necessarily have the lived experience of what many of these bands were writing about, but I think to hear them talk about it so powerfully and to address it so well, and the lyrics that they use is so impactful, that you feel like you've had, you can feel empathy with what they're saying, and you can feel like you've had a relationship almost with those people and what they've been through, especially like I say with Pearl Jam and Eddie Vedder's voice, and the way that he puts it across and his lyrics are so incredible that it is like I want to say he's my friend because he's one of the people I look up to the most. But you just feel like you've had that personal relationship with them, and you feel what they feel almost.
And as you mentioned there, this history of grunge has sort of had this, you know, tragic, well, been pockmarked by tragedy with, well, Cobain being the famous one. But Roskilde was a Pearl Jam concert as well, wasn't it? The sort of... The deaths of music fans in Denmark, and I believe I'm not hugely into Pearl Jam. I'm a big fan of 10, and I don't know too much about their sort of more recent stuff. But I think that sort of influenced maybe the stuff they did post 2000 as well. Is that right?
Yeah, and what happened there was obviously a crush happened in the crowd when Pearl Jam were on stage, and a number of people lost their lives. And in the aftermath of that, Pearl Jam really had a moment where they thought that they should just give it all up. They're one of the, it seems churlish to say, lucky ones that they're still, all of them are still around and they're still together and they're still making music. But they've been so beset by tragedy from the very beginning that they were formed out of the ashes of, you know, their big hope of becoming a massive band when they lost Andy Wood in Mother Love Bone. Then the crush happened. Then I think they were impacted by the fact of Pearl Jam and Nirvana famously didn't get along very well. Kurt Cobain thought that they were too commercial, and I think they stung a bit by his criticisms. But Eddie Vedder and Kurt Cobain, on a personal level, I think had a lot in common. Kurt Cobain and Eddie Vedder both looked up to a lot of DIY music, and I think if you ever get an opportunity to watch the Pearl Jam documentary, Eddie Vedder touches very closely on the fact that they would have good telephone conversations with one another, and he can still remember the Kurt Cobain's voice and things like that. But they were obviously moved by his death, and then they were when Alice in Chains, who Pearl Jam, when they were first touring under the name Mookie Blaylock, which is a basketball player who wore the number 10 shirt, which is why 10 is called 10. They supported Alice in Chains on their first tour, so they would have been like lost at that. And then they were extremely, extremely close with Soundgarden and Chris Cornell in particular, especially Matt Cameron when he joined Pearl Jam, was obviously in Soundgarden with him from the very beginning. So they are a band absolutely beset by tragedy, and I think one that the fact that they're still going is an incredible achievement. But I think all these losses does influence their music quite heavily, and they are still creating songs that are very moving. Like they released a new album late last year, and there's still songs on that that are just, you know, you can tell that if it was they could have easily written that in like 1991, 1992 about what was going on then. So yeah, I think they are such an incredible band. But like all of the bands, most of the bands, I shouldn't say all, because there were some awful bands that came out of Seattle, and especially in this sort of second wave when Silverchair were getting signed out of Australia and things like that. But there's so much good writing, good music, all beset by the same sort of tragedies because they were all living in the same city.
I was just on Cobain there before we move on. What was it that made Cobain such a sort of maybe even against his wishes perhaps, but what made him such a sort of mainstream star and success, or what made sort of Nirvana, or maybe I've misread it, and maybe it was perhaps a retrospective or posthumous thing that Nirvana were held in such high regard, but yeah, what was it that made Cobain such a star, perhaps more so than anyone else you've mentioned?
What he obviously had, he could write incredible pop music, which is to say that he absolutely hated the commercialization of grunge and of the Seattle music scene and the Washington music scene. He could write really good pop music that was accessible. You just have to listen to Nevermind and About a Girl That's on Bleach is a perfect pop song. And he loved music, and he loved pop music as well. And some of the covers that he did, even before MTV Unplugged, when he did some on Bleach and stuff like that, he knew music and he could write really good, catchy pop songs. And I think that really, you know, resonated with people. And I think he was so outspoken as well on cultural issues that impacted on the youth of America, not just of Washington, not just of Seattle and Aberdeen. He could touch on things that people were feeling, and he had a real good sense of, you know, culture. He was really outspoken on LGBT issues and on feminism and things like that at a time when perhaps, especially in music, it was so dominated by like bands like Guns N' Roses and Motley Crue and Skid Row and people like that were heavily misogynistic in what they were writing about. And he really railed against that, and I think that stood out to a lot of people as well. And he was just really he was sort of right place, right time as well, with a song as catchy, while also being sort of the stuff that your parents would hate, if Smells Like Teen Spirit really was a good song. And he was the one that kept, you know, once he's the big thing, people then want to focus on him and do interviews with him, and Chris Novoselic and Dave Grohl were really chatty as well, which really helped Nirvana. You just see it now, Dave Grohl still banging that drum. Less said about Chris Novoselic, his support for Donald Trump, the better probably. But, you know, Dave Grohl's still out there, still smiling, still writing incredible, catchy pop rock songs. So there was just something, almost, it must have been something in the water of Aberdeen rather than Seattle, that just blessed those three with the ability to write incredible pop music.
So when you talk about grunge now with your friends or family or whatever, or when perhaps maybe you meet someone new and you mention the fact you're into grunge, what is people's reaction? Because grunge is such a great word. It's sort of like it's sort of like semi-onomatopoeic, if that's a word it is now. It's got you can almost like feel a sort of a heavy guitar strum when you say that word grunge. What are people's reactions to it, and is there a current grunge scene that you're aware of? Or
I think if I was to speak to somebody about grunge music, I think it still has such a, it was so, even like 1993 in its heyday, it was so relentlessly mocked. There's a bit where Adam Sandler was on Saturday Night Live just taking the mick out of Eddie Vedder and Pearl Jam's enunciation. He's a big Pearl Jam fan, Adam Sandler, but obviously there is something in the fact that he was, you know, taking the mick out of the way that Eddie Vedder would sing. And even then, there was already almost a tide. I guess it's the same with anything that becomes popular. There's always going to be a tide ready to turn against it, and people ready to, you know, try and knock it down when it's having its most success. But I think that, you know, it's quite antiquated almost, even though it was only 30 years ago, that people still have this impression that it is just angsty, whiny music. And Pearl Jam, for all their benefits of surviving 30 years as a band, they are seen as like very old fashioned now, which seems odd to say it's only 30 years ago. And it's not like it was the Rolling Stones, who obviously still touring and things like that. But I think a few of them have bad reputations that's just brought on by time that's happened, and the genre as a whole perhaps hasn't aged very well. And I think it's the same with a lot of music scenes. People that have been influenced by grunge music and by Nirvana perhaps have done it better almost. And that sort of makes Nirvana, Soundgarden, Alice in Chains, Pearl Jam and the rest look a bit outdated. As for a current music scene, like I say, like 10, 15 years ago, when Puddle of Mudd, sort of the post-grunge, new third wave grunge sort of bands came around, Puddle of Mudd, Nickelback, Creed, they were already, they had huge success. Like How You Remind Me was a massive song, and Photograph and Hero and all those, and Blurry for Puddle of Mudd and things like that were huge songs at the time, but they already felt old and outdated and ready for mockery at that point. So I think grunge is so of its time and so closely knit to a specific area of one country that it's probably difficult to redo that scene. The Vines came around the same time as Nickelback, Puddle of Mudd and Creed, and they were sort of more the success story, and they were sort of the, whereas you could say Nickelback, Puddle of Mudd and Creed were sort of more Pearl Jammy, the Vines were more Nirvana-y, and they sort of disappeared quite quickly as well. So I think it is difficult to try and bring back a genre and a scene that's so intrinsically linked with four or more very big bands, and you're never going to have that success because it was very reliant on the time and the political situation that it found itself in, and of the people that were at the forefront of it. You're never going to have another Kurt Cobain, you're probably never going to have another Chris Cornell or Eddie Vedder, so it's difficult to try and get that same level of success. And hopefully, you know, no one try. You just, I think if anyone did try and do it now and do it, you'd just sound like a karaoke band, I think, if you were trying to repeat all those elements that made Seattle's music scene so good. I think you would just sound like you were just trying too hard to be like Nirvana or Pearl Jam or whichever one is your biggest influence.
I might be misremembering this, but you were in a band, weren't you? Were you anything like, were you at all grungy, or was your musical influence in your band slightly different?
I probably looked grungy. I had blonde, horrid dreadlocks, so I probably had a look of Layne Staley from Alice in Chains about me. But no, we were awful. We were called Adelaide. We played about five gigs. We were very much a hardcore band in the sense of sort of not even hardcore, metalcore band, sort of Atreyu and Avenged Sevenfold and those sort of bands. It's weird. Like that sort of, I'm really into sort of loud, heavy music, heavier than grunge, and bands like Fugazi and Minor Threat were such a big influence on Nirvana and Eddie Vedder in particular. But again, none of them sound like a lot of the bands that they were influenced by. So like the Beatles were obviously a big influence on Kurt Cobain, and you know, Fugazi was a big influence on Eddie Vedder, but they don't sound anything like the Beatles, or don't sound anything like Minor Threat and Fugazi. But no, we were not very grunge and not very good either. So yeah, thank you for bringing that up.
I'm sure we can find some photos as well. Those get them up on social media. Nickelback, are they good?
No.
Right, good. Because I don't think there's a band I know so little about, but whenever I see Nickelback mentioned at all, it's never in a positive light by anyone. I think there might be a bit of the whipping boys of sort of people who know about music, it seems.
I think what they struggled with, the fact that I think Chad Kroeger looked so old-fashioned even when they first came out. He had a goatee beard, he had long hair that looked like it had been crimped, and obviously crimping was very good, very very big in the 90s for women, not necessarily for men, but he didn't look like a rock star. The songs were very, you know, pop metally, not pop rocky, and you know, I think, you know, they're good. They're all right pop songs, like How I Remind You and Hero that he did for the Spider-Man soundtrack, and Rockstar and things like that. They're okay for what they are, but for, you know, they were so heavily influenced. Nickelback aren't even, but Creed were even worse. And Scott Stapp was not very nice person, it transpired in the end. But, you know, Nickelback are very much the whipping boys. And even now, like I touched on Puddle of Mud earlier, they released a song, or they released a video onto YouTube of them covering a Nirvana song, and he just, the vocalist of Puddle of Mud, who whose name escapes me and I've probably never bothered to actually learn, so forgive me if he's listening, but he's just awful. His vocals are awful. Like I say, anyone that tries to do Nirvana or tries to bring back grunge now will just sound like they're doing a karaoke version. That's very much, he's trying to sound too much like Kurt Cobain, that it just sounds absolutely terrible and absolutely ridiculous. But yeah, Nickelback, especially, I think also the fact that they're Canadian probably works against them, because, you know, Canada just has this reputation of being very nice people, but they will take, you know, they take the abuse that's thrown at them with such good grace that it's easy to just keep going and going. And I think that's possibly one of the things that Nickelback suffer from as well.
In the background, I think I heard your cat scampering about, and I believe he or she has a connection to grunge in some way.
So she. Is called Eddie. She's named after Eddie Vedder. And she, when we agreed, we've got two cats. One's called Rudy, who unfortunately is named after the former Manchester United player, Ruud van Nistelrooy, which wasn't my decision. But then when we decided we were going to get a second cat, it was with the agreement that I could name it as long as it wasn't called Alan. And so we got her. And yeah, regardless of gender, she was always going to be named Eddie. So yeah, she's named after Eddie Vedder, who is one of my favourite musicians, one of my favourite people, as if that hasn't come across already. But she's probably my least favourite creature in the world, which is unfortunate for both her and me. But she's all right as cats go, to be honest. But she's no. I'd swap her for the real Eddie Vedder any day.
Eddie Vedder, I think, is the only famous person that I can recall off the top of my head with the same birthday as me. So I've always had a soft spot for Eddie Vedder for that. Without wanting to turn this into Desert Island Discs, before we go, if I could maybe have some from you It might be tough to think of off the cuff, but maybe a top three or four grunge tracks or ones that maybe sort of you go back to the most or have the most significance for you.
It's difficult because I could give you just 10 Pearl Jam songs off the top of my head that would do, but I'll try and mix it up a little bit. So my favorite Pearl Jam song is probably not one of the main ones. It's called Given to Fly, and it's from Yield, which I think was released in about 1998. So sort of when grunge had really gone off the map almost, and it's about surfing. Eddie Vedder is a big surfer, but just some of the lyrics, especially in the closing stages, can be applied across the board to sort of any sort of situation. And it's just a beautiful song, especially lyrically, I think. I also love Wood by Alice in Chains, which is a really nice sort of heavy song. It was on the soundtrack to a film called Singles, which is a Cameron Crowe film who did Almost Famous, and that came out in about 1991, and that really capitalised on grunge music in Seattle. And they had Pearl Jammer in the film, Chris Cornell's in the film, there's a song from Alice in Chains in that film as well. And I think that's when sort of you could see that grunge music was starting to jump the shark, when they based a whole awful rom-com around it and all these stars of the music scene are in it. But yeah, I'd say Wood is a really good song as well. On a Plane is probably my favourite Nirvana song, off Nevermind. Again, that's quite a poppy song, probably not one that people would pick either. And then it's not really a grunge song, but I'm going to shout it out because it's Chris Cornell. But he did the most incredible cover, and I think it was only about maybe 4 or 5 years ago that he released it. But he did the most, I think it obviously gained more poignancy once he passed away, but he did the most amazing cover version of Nothing Compares to You as a sort of a live song for a radio station. And it's one of the most revisited YouTube videos that I'll go and watch. It's just him performing that. But then finally, I'll give you another Pearl Jam song, which is Release, which is the last song off 10, which is all in all probably about 10 minutes long. And it's a really simple, it's about two chords that just get played over and over again. And it's a song about Eddie Vedder losing his dad. And it's just an incredibly simple but incredibly beautiful song of what his dad would think of him if he could see the success that he gained off joining Pearl Jam and becoming a professional musician. And I've talked about the Pearl Jam documentary earlier, but there's a bit in that where he's talking about writing that song, and he's sat on a beach with an acoustic guitar and he just plays those two notes, and he talks about the loss of his dad, even though he never really knew that the man that he'd lost was his dad. And it's just very, very emotional and very special song. And it's one of the simplest but one of the best songs that I've ever heard. So I'd be amiss if I didn't at least give that a mention. But there's so many good songs I could give you. I could just give you the whole discography of every single grunge band and say listen to every single song that's on them. But yeah, there's just so, like, Where Did You Sleep Last Night on MTV Unplugged as well. Especially if you watch the video, there's a bit, it's the last song of that session, and Kurt Cobain, when he gives the final notes, just looks straight into the camera almost and just looks lost and emotional and angry and every emotion under the sun. And like, you look at it with hindsight and you can see that he was obviously a very troubled man that was going through a lot of difficult things, but that version, like almost putting it all aside and putting all that emotion into that song, is just fantastic. So I could be here all night and all day and all week and all month and the rest of 2020 giving you a list of amazing grunge songs, but I'll leave it at, you asked for three, I said I'd give you five, and then I've given you six. So I'll probably stop there before I give an entire back catalogue of one of the bands.
Okay, then that's absolutely fine. Plenty of homework for our listeners as a result, which is no problem at all. Finally then, Johnny, people who follow you on Twitter will know you've got a lot of interests, mainly sort of making jokes about football, which is absolutely fine. But why, when I offered you the choice of the whole wide universe of everything, did you want to do your lesson on grunge?
So when you asked me to prepare a lecture and to write something and come and talk about something, I wanted to do something that I absolutely love but very rarely have the opportunity to talk about. I love Newcastle United and Alan Shearer, and I love Football Manager and things like that, but I always have the opportunity. I'm also always grateful for the opportunity if anybody's listening and wants to book somebody to talk about Alan Shearer, Newcastle United or Football Manager. But I'm also always asked to talk about those subjects, and I've obviously talked to death about them, and anybody that's listened to me on a podcast before has probably heard me go into deep dives about my favourite Philippe Albert goal or my favourite new gen on Football Manager. So I thought I'd try and mix it up and talk about something else that I'm really passionate about that perhaps people won't have heard me speak about before. And I always, we talked about Desert Island Discs. I have a modest following on Twitter, but I don't think that's ever going to be enough to get me on Radio 4 talking to Lauren Laverne about my favourite songs, where I could, you know, give 8 or 9 or 10, 11, they might have to extend the format to make me go through all the grunge songs that I would like to include. But yeah, it was just an opportunity to talk about something a bit different that people might not have heard me talk about before. Perhaps have never looked into grunge beyond some Nirvana songs or some Pearl Jam songs or a bit of Soundgarden or Alice in Chains. So I'll hopefully get people out there and listening to a bit more. And I'm very grateful that you gave me the opportunity to come and talk so passionately about how much I love Eddie Vedder.
No problem at all. Lauren Laverne is from Middlesbrough, so maybe she would go for the whole Middlesbrough-Seattle metaphor. So
she was also in a band in the 90s, so there we go. That's a missed opportunity for all those A&R execs to make Middlesbrough the UK's Seattle.
Fair enough. Johnny, thank you so much. People probably do know you as Johnny Sharples off Twitter, but tying into the musical theme and tying into podcasting, you have a fantastic podcast that I listened to a couple of episodes of today that features music and features people talking about what they love.
So I decided in lockdown that I was going to start a podcast that I first had the idea about 18 months, 2 years ago, but never got off the ground. So it's called Your Fest, and it's all about... It's not all about music festivals, because we talk about all sorts on there, but it's mainly about music festivals. Each week we get a different guest on the podcast to talk us through their experiences of going to music festivals, and then we ask them to come up with their own dream music festival. So we ask them the name and location, and then we ask for their headlining bands. And we've had loads of great guests on there, but we've had lots of odd festivals that we've only had a couple that I probably would maybe go to. Ed Gamble had a good one because Slipknot played, and Johnny, not to give spoilers away, but Johnny Cash played, and we've had a few of us where you know, Queen have played and Spice Girls have played, and the film Bridesmaids has been shown. And yeah, it's really good having different people on to mix up the format. So we've had Asim Chowdhury from People Just Do Nothing, Ivo Graham, you know, Seuss Kempner, Lauren Patterson, Maisie Adam, some really good guests on there. It comes out every Monday. We've got lots more episodes lined up, lots more great guests lined up. So yeah, it's just an opportunity to talk about music. I hate music festivals, but I love music. The other presenter on there, Tommy, loves music festivals, loves music. He likes completely different sort of music to what I like. So hopefully we've got a good balance on there. We've got some good guests, like I say, and it's been a lot of fun. And hopefully once lockdown eases, we don't lose our pick of guests once they start going back on tour or start working again. So that's been one good side of being in lockdown. But yeah, it's been a lot of fun, and people should definitely listen, definitely follow us on Twitter, on Instagram, at Your Fest Podcast. I'll get a plug in before you cut me off.
No problem.
And hopefully don't edit that out. So yeah, it's been a lot of fun. And like I say, I hope it comes across here, but music's a massive passion of mine. So it's been great fun to go and talk about that with people like Ed Gamble and Asim Chowdhury that I look up to from a sort of celebrity point of view, and be able to sit down with them and talk to them about music's been so much fun and a massive privilege. So please listen. This is basically my Dragon's Den pitch to try and get Duncan Bannatyne to listen to our podcast.
I can't imagine what Bannatyne Fest would be like, but maybe that's a tale for another time and a tale for your podcast anyway. So, Johnny, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure. Hopefully I didn't bore you too much, but thank you.